today we're talking about microservices. Mm. And
sounds like fun.
I'm really excited that Charity is letting me chat about microservices with you. Unfortunately, I was going to speak tomorrow. Instead, Charity is going to speak about something even more amazing tomorrow, observability. I do have to leave because of a family issue. But I'm here today, and I get to pal with my pal Charity to talk to you about microservices. Probably, if you are curious or whatever, I'm just kind of like, show of hands, how many of you are currently microing some services? Most of you, according to some definition, right? Like, because that, I think, like deciding what exactly is microservices and what does it mean when you're making these kind of architectural changes is what we want to talk about today. It's not necessarily super simple.
All right, ready, whatever.
All right, Charity is reasonably happy. I feel like it's kind of like writing a novel, right? Like you're never actually done. You just kind of abandon it, or you're never actually done with slides.
Done.
You just kind of get them to where you're willing to show them to people. And also, AV is hard.
All right.
Computers are easy. AV is hard.
How many minutes do we have? 45? 40?
50.
Nice. 50. Awesome.
Nice. We have a lot to talk about.
All right. What is the topic? What is the subject of our talk today?
So I think it's this human side of microservices.
Keep calm and carry on. Yes.
I don't know. I'm not sure if I feel super calm. Maybe we'll calm down as we learn more about this.
Yeah. So we wanted to talk about the human side of microservices because ask anyone what was the hardest part about rolling it out, and they're like, the computers are easy. The people sucked. Not by sucked, like in a loving way. People are awesome, but they're hard.
Difficult.
Right? Like
it's hard. It's challenging. I mean, just syncing up with the work of other people. What?
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, I kind of wanted to talk about how to grow up, right? There's a lot of really awesome kind of canonical articles out there now about how to do microservices, like, from a technical perspective, so much so that I started feeling like I was just kind of, like, regurgitating all the things people like Susan have said better. But there isn't a lot of talk about just the pain and the angst of what happens to your teams as you're trying to actually align your workflows and your organizational stuff to your new technical
world. I think maybe if you probably already read our bios or whatever. So
yeah.
The short version, I work at Pivotal. I do tech advocacy for Cloud Foundry. And I've run microservices in production with fear, anger, tears.
Yeah, I was running microservices, and I didn't know that that was going to become a thing. It's kind of cool having it, like, I was like, oh, microservices, this shiny new, like, oh, wait, that's what we were doing, like, at Parse and at Linden Lab and at, no, it's cool. Like, I'm glad because I like having names, right? Being able to identify things gives you commonalities with other people who have done the same things who, you know, you weren't able to identify those overlaps and learn from each other.
Yeah, and at Drama Fever, we were yellowing.
We had a prettier one.
Yeah, no, it's okay. It doesn't matter. But at Drama Fever, we were yellowing some Docker-based microservices out into production in, like, 2013 because, you know.
So we're going to talk about basically five things. The interfaces and abstractions, operations, not a dirty word, communication channels, databases, and observability. But first, like, does anyone here feel like they need to know what a microservice is?
I do.
All right. Do you want to tell the lovely gentleman?
I think that it's easier to say, like, where do you set the bounds?
I think we can describe what the fights are that people have about what microservices are and are not. Etsy will say that what they are doing is definitely not microservices, and Cockcroft will say it definitely is microservices. But, like, basically it revolves around, like, these eternal debates. Monorepo? Multiple repos?
Or, like, exactly where you can alert and say, this service is working. Like, if your answer to is this service working, yes, no, is it depends, this part of no, that's not a microservice.
I would argue with that. I would say that there is no such thing as a system that is completely up or down.
Ooh, I like it. We've got the continuous partial failure at all times.
So there's a bunch of wankery out there about how it's like the two pizza team is like the largest team that you should have for a service.
And how hungry are these people and how large are these pizzas?
Exactly. I don't know. And they're in Seattle, so they like hike up and down mountains all the time. So like these units are just confusing.
Is it gluten-free pizza?
But I think that microservices are fundamentally about change control, about shifting the size, you know?
And the scope, like bounded context.
Yeah, which is obviously just kind of a continuation of what's been happening in technology for the past 10 or 15 years.
And fun fact, if you talk to people at Google who are like, you know, over the last year plus been decomposing, I bet some of you are in the room, decomposing the giant search microservice.
I love that word, decomposing.
I know it sounds like it's rotting, right? But when you get your service to the point where you can't keep the context and relationships in one person's head.
Yeah.
It may be too big.
Which kind of begs the question, could anyone ever keep it in their head? But whatever, that's fine. I actually like to think of microservices like a great effort on the side of big companies to make their employees feel that blissful feeling of working at a startup again. You know, where you got to have all this autonomy and you got to be like the master of your own destiny. And, you know, because otherwise you start feeling like you're working on just like a slice of a slice of a slice of a slice of a thing that somebody planned 5 years ago and half the time it doesn't even ship. And microservices is like an attempt to just kind of wrest that back.
And if you can keep the scope of what you're working on, the scope of one particular team's endeavor, to a manageable scope.
You can kind of do that. Support this. Have you all heard of Conway's Law? Sweet. I mostly included this because I wanted to show this. Wah, wah. But culture is important, right? Because it does so much heavy lifting for you. You can either be super prescriptive to people. You can be like, I want this and this and this is what our culture, you know. Or you can just be like, this is our mission. This is our culture, you know. And it's kind of like having an opinionated API. Like people are able to treat it to reason about it with their intuition.
And teams are going to develop their own cultures and ways of communicating with other teams. And especially if you have an awful lot of blocking on, you know, layers of bureaucracy and management and ServiceNow tickets and throwing things over the wall.
I almost didn't include this at all because I hate it when people talk about Conway's Law like it's a law. That really pisses me off. It's not. Like, Conway's Law is a law the same way that Godwin's Law is a law. Every conversation on the internet will eventually bring up Hitler, right? It's not a law of science. It just happens.
And if you're not familiar with Conway's Law, it just says that organizations that design systems are constrained to produce systems that are a copy of their communication structure. And I think that word communication
exactly.
is the one that Charity and I want to focus on.
Yeah. So basically the thesis of this is, you know, Conway's Law aside, you do in microservices, you do kind of want to think and treat the teams like you do the microservices, you know? They tend to have the exact same problems.
That's kind of funny too, because if you think about it, we've put a lot of work into dealing with like communication issues and distributed systems between the computers. But hello, what? The humans have a lot of these same problems. Whether it's, you know, a partition because time zones, or whether it's the...
Yeah. So these are the slides that I think we deleted from the section that you were editing that I didn't get merged.
our slides are eventually consistent.
Yeah, they're going to be consistent like tomorrow.
By the way, I would recommend that I have an anti-recommendation. You should definitely not try to use the... iCloud Keynote stuff,
yeah,
because it constantly tells you that the other person has changed.
The problem
you
is the network.
Reload.
I knew it.
And this, anyway, this is actually really relevant to microservices, too.
It's definitely relevant to computers.
Well, I mean specifically what you just said about the problem being the network.
Yes.
Because
you
decompose your monolith into microservices. You've now traded all your IPC for network lag.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
So, can you have microservices? Yes. And you don't have to go all in. You do not have to do everything that they say in, like, the 7 steps of microservices. You can pick and choose. You should pick and choose. You would be an idiot to just go from, like, a monolith to a microservices, like, immediately. And whenever people on the internet tell you that there is a right way to do things, you have my permission to roll your eyes and say, no, there isn't.
Even us.
There are better degrees, except when we're talking.
Well, like for example, I mean, if we're gonna go with like, you know, numbered clickbait lists, well, 12 factor apps. How many of the 12 are really important?
Three.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, pick an arbitrary number. You probably don't have to do all of the things.
The thing is that they are an ideal, though. They are a direction that, unless you have a really goddamn good reason, you should be moving in that direction. I don't know if you were reading Twitter, but I've sent out calls for disasters a couple of times, and the little ponies are going to be here to tell you, I swear to God, every single one of these is a true quote from a real human who I've promised shall not be named on the internet.
None of them were me, but they're hilarious.
None of them were Bridget. I asked, how did this transition to microservices go? And the poor fellow said, we got rid of our ops team because we decided that software engineers should be on call. So all the software engineers quit. And it was a death spiral. And then I quit. And I was like, ooh. And he's like, yeah. You know, the context was like, I was like, software engineers should be on call. And he's like, well, this happened. And I'm like, well, I didn't say you should do it stupidly. This is not like a switch that you just flip the next day because you heard it was a best practice.
And like, I spent from 1999 until 2015 on call for production, and the most stressful on calls are the ones where you get paged about something that you can't do. You can't do jack shit about.
You should not make people responsible for a thing that you cannot empower them to and reasonably expect them to perform. That's just a recipe for giant stress.
Or even give them any access to whatsoever.
We'll get to that. There is a key point that I would like to stress, though, which is that if you're going to be doing microservices, and probably all of you in this room this applies to, but you should be good at operations because it takes advanced operations skills. It takes a team that values operations and knows how to get better at it.
I think that's like a super important point. Microservices aren't easier.
They're not easier.
They're actually harder. They're really beneficial because you can decontextualize like different people's projects and ship different parts at different speeds and not wait for the big bang deploy. I mean, there's a lot of value there.
If you need that value, right? If you can run your app on a LAMP stack, you should do that. Your life will be better. You know? You should always use the simplest architecture that achieves your objectives and also make sure that you have the right objectives.
One time I was in an open space at an Agile conference, which I don't even know. But I was in an open space, and the person told me that their VP had said that they were going to be doing microservices in Q4. And I was just like, what? Like, if your VP read that, like, what color do they want that microservice to be? Because mauve has the most RAM, right?
Polka dots. Yeah. Polka dot microservices. Yeah.
Like, they shouldn't be a goal. They should be a result of needs you have inside your organization.
They're a consequence, not the goal. Some other important questions to ask yourself and the people around you. You know, how many products or services do you really have? Small is not better if you're just duplicating the number of problems and things you had to be paged about. If it's the same team, if it's the same problem, then one service, you know? And also, everything is hybrid. Like, literally everything is hybrid. And your databases, even if you're fully microservices, you're still going to have, like, service registry that hopefully there's only one source of truth, right? So it's a pretty common model, actually, for there to be one big, fat monoservice for a long time that you just kind of slowly spin things off of.
Yeah, that's your – I think they call it the strangler pattern, which they're talking about vines and not, you know, murdering.
Sweet. Don't reinvent too many wheels. If it's not core to your business, don't innovate there.
I think there was when I worked at the little streaming video site that was like Netflix but for Korean soap opera, we built, Drama Fever, now owned by the WB. I don't work there anymore. But when we built an image resizer, and it was a Go-based microservice, and it was kind of brittle and complex, and I think it's a are you okay endpoint, just return 200 all the time, and, you know, things were terrifying. And we eventually just realized, you know what? Why do we have a specialist microservice to do this thing that we can do from SaaS? Like, this isn't core to our business.
Yes. Also, if you can use a SaaS, do so. And I don't say that just because I happen to have recently founded a company that is a SaaS.
I don't work at her company, but you should use her company. Pivotal signed up with them.
The
They're an ISV for us.
It is the future. That's true. Love Pivotal. It is the future. SaaS is the future. Anytime somebody tells you that you can't use a SaaS, you should ask why. And ask it like 5 times. And maybe the answer really is you can't use a SaaS. But most of the time when they say that, it isn't true. And it will save you money. It will save you like the more cycles that you could give to your core business objectives, the better. You remember like back in 1999 when Gmail launched? Remember how we all used to train our own spam filters and antivirus filters? Oh my God. Were those the good old days? No, like suddenly we all woke up and went, holy shit, like we can have another whole engineer like working on our product instead of our email that's terrible anyway. Like I feel like the world is undergoing this transition for a lot of things right now, like metrics and like,
yeah,
and
like Pivotal has a cloud, you know, platform, and we still pipe our metrics into third-party services. We still partner
because
with people like Honeycomb.
Because if it is someone else's mission, they will do a better job than you when it's not your mission.
Yeah, like we want to help organizations change how they develop software. We do not want to be the best social debugging and introspection that exists.
A plus advertisement on both of our parts. Okay.
Hey, we work at vendors, all right?
Somebody who's
not
me
paid my plane ticket here.
And if you haven't read Dan McKinley's post on choosing boring technology, you should do so. And if you've read that post but you haven't read Jesse Tron's post on where you should introduce risk into your stack, you should do so there too. Spoiler alert, developer tools, risk. Databases, no risk.
This is, I think, one of those places it's really difficult to convince the engineers in the room who are very excited about practicing resume-driven development that perhaps the most exciting thing would be
fucking
building
Silicon
a product
Valley.
That works.
Yeah, yeah. Hey. This is my slide to talk about my Twitter responses.
These are great.
They're coming up. You should be so excited. But the reason that this is hard is because it's hard, because it's new. You know, anytime you're doing new things, you are blazing a trail. And that's fun and it's exciting, but it's also stressful and hard. it leaves you with software that takes 3 days to deploy sometimes. Anyway, all right, number one, interfaces and abstractions. It's a useful metaphor here because your services, your team is like your service, right? In microservices, you have to treat the teams themselves like the services. They have the same problems. They have the problems of scalability, of having to, you know, map your resource availability to the amount of work that you need to do. You need to worry about having enough redundancy of knowledge and about, you know, leaving enough breadcrumbs for yourself to figure out what's happening.
Oh, yeah, the single point of failure. So, like, if you are going to go to a conference but be working the whole time because, you know, you have to fix Elasticsearch while you're at the conference instead of playing Werewolf, probably there's not enough redundancy in your org as to people who understand that.
Yeah. Responsibility and ownership, you know, and as Bridget likes to say, if you cannot consider decentralizing your control, you are not tall enough to ride this microservices ride.
That's a Martin Fowler quote, actually, but I do like to quote him. The microservices are more work, so you have to be paradoxically willing to let go.
Yeah.
And if the people who are holding whatever reins of control inside your organization are not willing to let go, your organization is not organizationally mature enough.
I get it.
To
it's
be
nice
decentralized.
To be needed. It's really nice to be a hero the first time.
Or the nth time when you're like, you know, rocking silently, sobbing on the floor of your office.
3 a.m. Yeah. You've been there for 2 days. So you can't take this metaphor infinitely far, right? But you can take it a long way. For example, please do not shoot the other human in the head when one goes down.
But do let the other person go on, you know, vacation and don't call them.
Yeah, it's actually a really good, well, we have more in here about that. But ownership, however, is incredibly key. Every service needs to have clear human ownership. Just like you have a clear pool of resources. You know, I think that I don't know that I've ever worked any place, including my place, you know, where we think enough about, okay, do we have coverage? Do we have coverage for all the things that we are implicitly signed up to support? You know, that's not a thing that you can just set up once and forget about it. It has to be reevaluated, you know, once a quarter, you know, once a month. Whatever.
Because otherwise you're going to run into a situation where my boss Tim and I left Drama Fever within a week of each other, and our last couple of weeks there were basically just ops boot camp for the developers who are about to try being on call. We should have done that much earlier.
Yeah. I mean, we've all been at these teams that spend more time actually routing jobs around than actually fixing the stuff. But we've also been on teams where things are not explicitly routed and explicitly owned. So there are a few people, bless them, who end up doing all the shit work. And then one day they go postal or they don't come to work. Or you don't want to burn those people out just because they're willing to do all of this awful labor.
And burnout is a real problem.
It is.
Also that single point of human failure is inevitably at some point not going to be available. So
if management has one job and only one job, it is the mission. You know, just like Bridget was saying about you shouldn't adopt microservices if it is not in your mission's best interest. You should know what your mission is. Right? If you don't know what your mission is, if you aren't inspired by it, someone in the management chain isn't doing their job. If you're the manager, double on you. I can't stress this enough. Like, I feel like we don't talk about this enough. This is why people get, if you don't care about your mission, that's one thing. You should find a new job. Or if they don't pay you enough money to not care about your mission, also legit, like super legit to get drowned in money and not care about your mission. But if you don't have one or the other, you know, like, we actually do really awesome things with computers, like every day. We do amazing things. We have a lot of power. We are incredibly well compensated, but we have so much fun too. And I see people every day just getting like burned out and sad, and this is not necessary. This is not how life has to be.
And I think I know a lot of people at, you know, larger organizations have started to come to SREcon because they want to get them some of that Google and Facebook, you know, microservices joy or whatever. I think that this scaling from you have a small team and everyone talks to each other and everyone understands what's going on.
How many of you know the Dunbar number? Nice.
Bunch of people.
The Dunbar number is roughly, so it's a number from sociology. It's the approximate number around 140, which is the number of connections you can sort of keep in your head about how every one of them relates to each other. And it's a number that sort of, there's like physical bound in the brain, like based on the number of neurons we have or something.
And as it turns out, LinkedIn and Twitter do not have this built into them. So please don't be offended if you come up and say hi and we're just like, hi, you.
So,
and you're like, we know each
other.
So
basically, like throughout history, you see tribes, you see military units and everything. And like they divide when they get over like 100-ish because you can no longer rely on these informal means of like relationships and communication. You have to rely on formality, you know? This is why management exists in large part. It's to route. It's so that there's one person that you can go to just ask a question, you know? And you know because they're the team lead or the manager or whatever.
But inside these larger organizations, building more connectivity between the teams does help because otherwise you are routing everything up the management chain back down.
As you grow,
we've all worked there, and that's
as
terrible.
You grow, you have to pay attention to this. You have to intentionally make these new neural paths. You know, you have to intentionally think about how people can get to the right person on whatever team to get something done.
And this is something that management can enable.
Yes.
You know,
you can chaos monkey your teams and your people. You should.
What we were talking about earlier, I mean, some organizations have gone so far as to say, you know, go home, take the rest of the day off.
We have mandatory vacation. Like, I don't like an unlimited vacation. You're allowed to disagree with me. But I feel like people don't take it, you know? So we have 3-month vacation policy, but you have to take 2 weeks a year.
And
for the good of humanity.
And for the good of Honeycomb. You just did this. I mean, you went to India. I've been to India. The internet is sort of not great. But still, you're able to
do as I say, not as I do. This is one of my favorite disaster stories. Oh, my God, this poor person. Just dropped in here randomly. This was one of the things that I was trying to sort at the last minute. So really, blame Obama.
Hashtag thanks, Obama.
Our deploys took 3 days to run from start to finish.
I actually feel like that's not entirely that rare.
We never managed to convince our PM that not every deploy needed to be personally approved by him. This is the same person. And every single time that they did a deploy, they had to manually edit the JSON and do something with a marathon. I don't know what that is. Mesos? Whatever. This is a signal that your ops skills are perhaps not up to snuff.
And it's also a signal that you may be deploying too much.
It's a lot of signals. I mean, we could spend we can do a whole talk about all the things that are indicated by this.
That's kind of one of those, you've all probably seen the sawtooth of like, giant changes, everything is really risky. Okay, we've deployed.
Literally the entire point of microservices is to not do that. Like somewhere a packet got dropped. I don't know. If you don't know how to prioritize ops work, it's not going to get better once you have microservices.
And this is very similar to the orgs that are all about feature velocity, but don't want to put...
How?
They don't want to put any time into, hey, let people have a little bit of time in their schedule to actually...
People keep saying how infrastructure is not sexy. I don't get it. I think it is.
I think infrastructure is really interesting, but I also think that when... your project management or your product org or whatever is really into shipping the new feature, but not making sure that the thing you shipped yesterday
definitely
actually
can't get
works.
Away with that. So next category, communication channels. And I was going to put a picture of like a river or a stream here because communication will find a way to get through. It's very hard to say, and so you just generally should not try to say stop communicating. Good luck with that. You can redirect them. Sometimes you can be intentional about them, but if somebody's communicating something, there's a reason for it, you know, and you should probably figure out what's motivating it. Were you about to say something?
Yeah. I was just going to agree with you that you pay just as much attention to when they aren't communicating something.
That is so hard and so important.
Because if they stop telling you about problems,
anytime somebody tells you there's a problem, you can guarantee that there's 10 to 25 to 1,000 people who had a problem and didn't tell you. Like, always say thank you. Thank you for telling me about this problem because, you know, it actually takes guts. And this is something that loudmouths like me and Bridget can forget because we are yapping all the time about things that are wrong. But it's really hard for most people in most circumstances. Or it takes your energy. Like, this is a real thing. I'll get too lazy to tell somebody that something's wrong. I'll just be angry or irritated or, like, I'll detach, right?
And also if people, especially if the segmentation inside your organization is such that people think, if I bring this up, it won't get solved and maybe it'll get better. And maybe they'll take away the loophole that lets me get my job done right now.
Loopholes. Yeah, you really don't want to run your microservices based on a loophole-based architecture.
But we've all been there, right?
More communication, just like more speech is usually better. Usually, not always.
And more again, like, you know, people love to talk about blamelessness and whatever, mm-hmm. but honestly, like, don't shoot the messenger because if somebody feels like their life is going to become worse because they mm-hmm. told you about the outage or the problem or whatever, it'll land in their lap and it'll be their fault. Like, they won't tell you.
I feel like people and organizations don't spend enough time and energy on this in general. Here are some examples of communication flows. Pull requests, code reviews, reporting structures, management chains, work schedules, when you're in the office, when you're not in the office. That's a means of communication. Your one-on-ones, your on-call rotations. That's a means of communication. I feel like communication, like, we think of this as being, like, you know, us talking to our managers or each other, but, like, just in the way that, like, the Supreme Court has defined, you know, speech to include money, fine, cool. It's just a way of exchanging information. We need to think about all of the many and various, like, forms of communication takes. And this really, this is very much parallel. You can take your systems thinking, you know, that you use for microservices and systems and apply it to the human realm, just like you can do the reverse so often.
And for example, I would say
happy hour is a communication flow.
So like at Pivotal, we do a lot of pair programming. And one place that can break down is if you just have the next person rotate on to that problem and the person with context stays on it and you never actually write the active working state to disk.
Yep.
Like, hey, what happens when the person who had the most context
this
isn't
is
in the next day?
Big argument for not making yourself too busy to periodically flush to disk. Your MMAP buffers are getting full.
And I'm not saying, like, spend all your time writing really long documentation. This can just be as simple as when you make the commit in GitHub, your actual reason. Like, don't say what the code does. I can read code. I can see what it does. But why, past self?
Yep.
Why?
Indeed. You cannot debug something that you can't name, you know? this is observability for the human sphere. Like the way that we debug human systems is through communication. And you have to start this process before something is wrong. Because just like you need to know what your green state is like before you can even tell if there are errors in your dashboard, like you need to have a good working, you need to like start having these conversations before something's wrong, because then it's too late. You don't know if this person that you're having a one-on-one with who seems really grumpy and like quiet, is that how they usually are? Sometimes people are very happy and they come across that way.
And this, I think, is particularly relevant in the realm of microservices that are managed by, you know, end-to-end by, you know, full-stack teams. Yeah. How many? It's like, what is full-stack either? Like, are they writing silicone? Like, it's all.
Yeah, unless you're designing a chip while you're, like, making your web page pretty, I don't really want to hear from you. Have you guys heard the phrase smart nodes, dumb pipes? I like thinking about management and engineers this way. Managers' jobs is primarily facilitating nodes. You know, there should not be intelligence in your network. And there should not be intelligence, your managers should not be overly clever either. Like, they're really just for, like, forwarding, you know, and routing information. Do you want your manager describing the answer to the complex technical problem that somebody just asked about your team and their work?
I mean, I think that this is one of those places where it really depends on your team size.
Absolutely.
Well, because Charity is CEO and also, like, you know, in charge of a whole bunch of your architecture. Yeah. But when you get to a lot larger,
well,
yeah.
And I don't mean to shit-talk managers, obviously, because I don't know. But if we let it be seen as a promotion instead of a sidestep, we're in trouble. If we fail to create equally fulfilling and rich roles for senior ICs as for managers, then people think, like, the reason people think that that's the only way that they can get promoted and like, make progress in their career is because people actually make it that way. Like, they're not making things up. That is legitimately the only way to advance in many, if not most, organizations.
I think Lindsay Holmwood had a really good blog post about management not being a promotion, it being a new job. Mm-hmm. And
which is why you're going to be miserable for the first couple of years. Absolutely miserable.
The good news is it's not a one-way trapdoor function. I did it for 7 years, and then
yes.
I went back to being an IC. And
I so believe, we're going off on so many tangents here, that's fine. I so believe that the best engineers in the world are the ones who have spent time in management, and the best managers in the world, like, if you're talking, like, low-level tech lead managers, are the ones who periodically go back and forth, like, no, you know, every 5 years or so.
But back to microservices.
Back to microservices. You can't fix something until you understand it, and it's really hard to create monitoring checks for people, so we talk to each other.
And this kind of goes to, like, observability being the watchword.
Well, not quite yet. Well, yes.
Okay. I mean, but it's like, it's pointing that way, right? Because
we're just going to pretend that that didn't happen.
Because if you can't answer any questions about your systems, it's going to be really hard to solve problems about them.
Yes. Ops is just another engineering specialty. Or it's just a way of doing software engineering, right? Just like writing tests, just like understanding databases, debugging queries, you know, debugging the query planner, rewriting, you know. It is understanding how to do your infrastructure. It's just another specialty. And
I think if you're going to be successful in your organization with microservices, yeah. You probably do need a substrate that has some specialists actually making sure that all of the plumbing and all of the pieces that the microservices rely on actually work.
It's a really interesting question. Like, what happens to ops orgs in a microservices framework, right? One that I've seen work really well is ops as consultant, you know, where you have software engineers who own their services and you have ops teams that are attached to that service, like pairing with those developers, you know, when they're spinning it up, when they're getting it online, or when it's having a lot of scaling issues, when they're having, you know, to like rethink the entire way that they're doing anything, because this is our specialty, you know, is making services run really, really well, you know, giant co-tenancy problems.
I like how Catherine Daniels from Etsy puts it, of designated ops, not dedicated ops.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah. But it depends, again, it depends on what your services are, right? At Parse, for example, ops pretty much ran the show. Like, we were the DBAs. What was Parse but a giant multi-tenant, like, operations platform, you know? It was an interesting inverse of how, you know, in many places devs kind of call the shots. We just push them around. But ops has to be willing to let go, too. You know, you have to be willing to let people make mistakes. This is a big one, you know. You have to let people fail a little bit.
And I think that that's maybe one of the places where being in ops for a long time, it's kind of hard to let go of your ego because you know you can do a better job of some specific circumscribed set of things. And opening
and you have
up
a lot of your identity wrapped up and everything going well.
Yeah, you have a lot of your identity wrapped up and everything working all the time, damn it. And opening things up enough to let other people have the flex that they need to carry out the mission that Charity alluded to before is, I think, one of the difficult roles in modern ops, but really necessary.
You can't ask someone to care about something and fix it without giving them the power and the responsibility. And you'll find that, like, this is what creates caring. You know, if you're like, oh, they don't care enough, you know, they don't value it as much. Are you really giving them the ability to fail and to own it? You know, if you're babysitting them all the time, then what incentive do they have to take their own pride in how well they're doing?
I just noticed it said next slide 42 of
way
more.
No, don't worry about it. We do need to speed up a little, but like we're at 4 of 5. I interviewed with a company as the first ops hire. They said they wanted me to come help them learn how to be on call for their own services. I joined and then learned that they meant I was going to be on call all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, until someday when they definitely wanted it.
This is actually interesting to me because I did join a startup as the first ops hire and was the only ops person for 2 years. But the devs had already been on call and continued to be on call with me. And there was occasionally a time when my phone would ring at 3 in the morning, even though I wasn't currently on call. But I tried very hard to make sure that I wasn't a single point of failure
for
a lot of
things. Do they have to be on call? It all depends. It really depends on who you've got and what you've got, but it helps. But the point of it is it's not, and sometimes software engineers act like we're just like gratuitously like subjecting them to torment. Okay, so A, on-call duty should not be hell. Like, if it's hell, like, and like, ops people bear a lot of responsibility for the shit that we have like subjected ourselves to and the whole martyr complex that we've had for so long. But that's not okay for us either. Like, I don't want my life to be impacted that way.
And some of that also comes from the way the organization's priorities are set up. So if the organization is all about ship it and then let it burn, you know, ops will prop it up while you continue to ship more.
Or page everyone whenever, like, a bird flaps its wings too near to the data center. Like, no, you have an error budget. Use it.
And that's, and I feel like that, if you're looking at, you know, an organization and deciding how healthy it is, I think maybe a good measure is, what is on-call like? If it's that terrible, you have other problems.
I can't possibly be on-call for my own services. I won't get any work done. What the hell do you think I do all day, you know? And this one came from a manager. He's like, well, I think my software engineer's time is just too valuable to spend on reliability work. We need these features to ship. Okay.
Do you also need the features to work?
Nah, that doesn't seem important. Snowflakes are very, very, very costly. Now, when you start out, that's all you have. And that's cool. You're probably going to fail. Most startups do. But if you don't, like, part of the growing up process is getting rid of these snowflakes and standardizing.
And I think that's even a problem inside larger organizations. Like,
oh, yeah.
At Pivotal, so, I go in and I talk to a lot of really large organizations. And a lot of times, somebody has, you know, a Jenkins server under their desk, or they have like
one particular
group that is trying to, you know, Docker all the Dockers or get some Kubernetes, you know, going. And like, you're wondering exactly how is that going to get glued to what the rest of the organization is doing?
If you've made your processes too tight, and if there's no flux, if there's no room for people to do kind of one-offs and weird stuff, you're going to have more of a problem with this.
We're back to human problems? What?
Yeah. Oh. I know. Humans all the way down.
I don't know about you, but I majored in computer science thinking I would not spend all my time dealing with human problems.
That was the point.
That was a bait and switch.
This goes for humans too, though. Like, at our stage, like, we have now 8 people at Honeycomb. We're getting to the point where we cannot, like, negotiate one-offs for, like, we have to have salary bands or it's not fair. You know, in the early days, it was like, how little could we live on, you know, and it was very tailored one by one. We have to grow up.
And we have like 2,000 people at Pivotal, so it's obviously an order of magnitude more complex on the people interaction side, but we still try to have a lot of the stuff you're talking about.
This is a two-pager. Oh, this guy. There is a serious breach elsewhere in the industry. My bosses overreacted and locked down more than they needed for PCI. Nobody had the access they needed to get the work done. Network folks were in another office. We felt like second-class citizens. The big challenge was network firewall stuff. Things were so locked down, two nodes on the same VLAN couldn't communicate on a given port. Changes were unannounced. There was no way of predicting them or getting a log of what had happened. Because security. And sometimes, oops, changes would regress somehow, and now service X couldn't talk to Y, and messages were just building up in the message bus, and we couldn't reach the team and had no access to investigate ourselves. Security.
And this is actually probably more typical than you would want
it's
it
super,
to be.
It's super, super common.
I mean, a lot of large organizations really want security and compliance and audit
and
all those good things.
And they think that black boxes are secure. So like, cool, if the network is only debuggable by process, if you can't actually do any like crazy like by hand stuff, then we'll just give you a, you know, this manual that has these steps that are completely opaque, and then it's secure. But like, you have to point directly at the place where humans initiate change. And if
you give people a route around the normal change control process for emergencies,
they'll use that every time.
I got to tell you, the last time years ago that I worked someplace that had, you know, really heavyweight change control, everything was an emergency. I don't know why. It just happened that everything was
we
an
have
emergency
to trust
much
each
faster.
Other. Like
I didn't
we do.
Want to fill out
like
a 42-page form.
Systems that are built based on trust work better. And I believe that just like the systems that are secure are not built on this like unachievable goal of like perfect security. It's built on auditability. Like I feel like if that's your concern,
And exactly, like the part where you can use logs, you can, you know, if you want to call it infrastructure as code or whatever.
Yeah, we gotta speed up, honey.
You know.
Sorry. I know.
I know.
We have two more points, and we have to get through them. When you're interviewing, ask ops questions for every single person. It doesn't actually matter that they know the answers. It matters because you're signaling that operations is valued. So it's not going to be a surprise to them later when you want them to be on call or be responsible for their own stuff. Your promotion process. Nobody should become a senior engineer if they have a reputation for not being willing to take the operability of their own software and others seriously. Don't promote them. That is a signal. It's back to communication. Like you're creating these communication flows that show that it's optional. It's not optional. It's not a nice to have.
The amount of time spent, time, money, effort, human capital, blood, sweat, and tears spent developing a service versus operating it into production.
You can round
the future,
it down to zero. You spend approximately zero time developing this service compared to operating it. Data, just another service. It is impossible to treat stateful services exactly like stateless services. But you should try really hard. You should lean towards making them exactly the same.
I think this is where a lot of people get tripped up because they want to have all of their completely disparate microservices that are being developed at different rates and having all sorts of unknown like schema-related changes happening, talking to the same monolithic data store.
Yes. Treating it like an API, using service brokers, all of these are almost always good things. It does lead to illicit pathologies of its own. But all of life is just about trading for better sets of problems. It's not that you're getting rid of the problems. It's that you have a slightly better set of problems. And this is a better set.
Slightly more manageable anyway.
Also, favorite joke, who's your DBA? If you don't know the answer, you're the DBA. It's probably you. It's fine. Everything's going to be okay. Data is really fun. After working on databases, you're not going to want to go back. You're going to be like, networking? Jesus Christ. Like, everything's just so ephemeral. Like, you cannot screw over a company completely with just the network.
That sounds like a challenge.
Here's one of my favorite outages. This is one of two companies. First one is, my DBAs didn't trust us to touch the databases, so they were the only ones with passwords, even though we were all on call for our own services. So sometimes, they just wouldn't wake up. And we'd all be sitting around, helplessly unable to do anything about our half dozen services that were down. Uncool. Definitely uncool. Another one said, different companies, I swear. The other one said, the software engineers didn't want to understand what was happening. They just wanted a recipe to fix it when a database got slow. They would literally run commands from my shell history without stopping to read them or understand what they did.
Ensley, if that were going to work, you would have auto remediation set up with those commands already.
One definitely hopes. Oh, God, that's right. Hilariously, these people were on the same team. I forgot about that. They were on the exact same team. So, kids, what have we learned today? They didn't trust each other, and they were hell-bent on not trusting each other. And lastly, observability. This is the rock on which everything is constructed. You know, observability for humans, observability for your systems. Because, again, you cannot fix something that you can't understand and debug and interact with. And on the technical side, obviously, you know, you need your top-level end-to-end checks. You need your tools for exploring and debugging complex systems like Honeycomb.
And what you need is everyone in the organization who's going to be interacting with the system, who's going to be on call, who's going to be making product decisions.
Bridget likes to call this democratizing observability.
Democratizing observability means that you won't have somebody coming to you and asking, can you look up for me what's going on with this?
Come on.
And you're like, there's dashboards.
Look, everybody does a better job when they have better data, right? So we should be looking for ways to like help everyone get this data for themselves.
I think one of my favorite outages a couple of startups ago was we had a customer. It was a giant Toys R company. I know.
We're out of time.
I'm just saying it was a. They accidentally took our third-party cookie widget off of their front page, and so the traffic from them like dropped to zero. We had this observable, viewable by people in the customer success team. They could see that. They could see what was wrong, called the customer and fixed it before I even rolled in for stand-up. I'm like,
yes,
success.
It's nice. If you give them the power to do your job, they might do that too. People observability. You know, you got to talk to people, encourage other people to talk to each other. This doesn't happen enough. A lot of people, and this always surprises me, a lot of people are sitting around waiting for permission. Don't be one of those people. Like obviously within reason, but like do it. If you're sitting around waiting for someone to tell you, yes, you can talk to this person. Yes, you can do this job, pick up this thing. Do it. Usually it's good.
I was just visiting customers at a large bank and speaking at their internal event. And the main takeaway they wanted me to make sure all of the devs and ops people at this event heard was that they are empowered to try things.
Yes.
And this is like large, stodgy bank.
It's always going to be hard. If you're doing microservices, you're signing up to do something hard, which is why it's fun. I think this is my last one. And it isn't that great, so fuck it. You have a responsibility to your team's well-being, whether you're a manager or not. Like, we all have this shared responsibility. And it's kind of it's a very virtuous feedback cycle wherein the more you do, the more power and impact you'll have. So if you feel like you don't have any, just start doing things. I guarantee you, you'll start to be one of the people that everyone looks to like help everything work.
Yeah. And that's, I feel like we could show a lot more slides that relate to this, but
almost done.
I mean, okay. Just the TLDR wrap-up.
Yes, the TLDR wrap-up. Talk to people before you start microservicification. Don't do what these wonderful people did, which they started just rolling out containers, and they did it in such a bad way that now literally nobody who ever works at that organization will ever touch containers again. Has nothing to do with containers.
Containers aren't magic. They're delightful, but they won't actually fix any of the problems inside your architecture or culture. What?
Change is the only constant, so seek feedback and move forward. Get your buy-in. Most failures happen around transition.
We could show more slides forever, but I think probably a good place to wrap up is just your point right here.
Only innovate when you need to. Can you remember stuff? Empower yourself.
I actually think that only innovate when you need to is right back to the microservices.
Yeah. And look for the uncomfortable places and like roll towards them, because don't let them fester and become technical debt or human debt. There is no fairy tale answer, even microservices. But hard things are still hard, even when they're scheduled and small.
And we will be outside afterwards and post slides.
Questions,
so we can talk
outside.
About it. We are way out of time for questions up here.
Apologize. Yeah.
Nice.
actually, I want to take a minute or two to just like let Charity and I just kind of give our final point. Your final point.
What's my final point?
Oh, well, I thought you wanted to wrap up a little bit.
I did, right there. That's it.
All right. There is a lot of TLDR.
That one. There we go. Boop.
There we go.
That's what I meant.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
They're not actually going to fix everything. They make everything way better, but there's still a huge amount of human work to do.
Good job, Bridget.
Good job,
Bridget. Thank you. Cool. I guess we have time to take a couple of questions, if anyone has any. We explained everything perfectly. That's what I'm hearing. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much.